First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
Jacksonville activists call once again for police reform. Good morning. We're live from Studio 2. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, local reaction to the killing in Memphis of Tyre Nichols. It's 549-2937 to join us. Then later, two candidates for Jacksonville mayor take to the airwaves, the ad wars, over supporting the failed attempt to sell JEA. That's ahead too, and much more. But first this morning, local activists are joining the national call to demand justice for Tyre Nichols, the 29-year-old Memphis man who died 3 days after a traffic stop. Five officers were fired and are now facing criminal charges in Nichols' death, including second-degree murder. The Jacksonville Community Action Alliance held a rally downtown over the weekend to call for policing reform in this city and more oversight of JSO. Executive Director Michael Sampson of the JCAC is on the line with more. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for having me on.
And it's 549-2937 to join us. So over the weekend, you and others in the city who have been affected by police violence rallied downtown. Tell us about that.
Yes, ma'am. Yeah, we rallied downtown to remember Tyre Nichols, also Keenan Anderson in Los Angeles, Manny in Atlanta, who just was recently killed by law enforcement there, as well as other victims of police violence. And it's always important for us to understand that, you know, that was a tragedy, and we're tired of seeing this body, this horrible body camera footage that's unwatchable to see man's life treated with such lack of worth. But I think it's important to understand that the situation in Memphis, you've had incidents like that in Jacksonville, and it's important for us to keep pushing for civilian oversight for police reforms that have not happened since 2020. And, you know, how many more Tyre Nichols will we see before we see some action from our lawmakers?
Yeah, since the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis, there have been some reforms to policing, in particular body cameras, which are now regulation here in Jacksonville. Of course, it was police body cameras and other footage in Memphis that enabled people to see Nichols being beat to death. At the same time, you at the Jacksonville Community Action Alliance are calling for more civilian oversight over our police, over the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office. What are you asking for?
So one of the things that we have been pushing for in the past few years has been more civilian oversight. We're calling for a public safety oversight committee. And it's an initiative that we're going to be getting ballot initiatives for and going straight to the ballot in 2024. Over the past few years, you've seen the city council fueled by inaction when it comes to police reforms. The late councilman, President Tom Hazzouri, created the Safer Together Committee, which was having important discussions about reform and kind of bridging that gap. And of course, that was shut down by the sheriff's office. So, you know, there's been a lack of political will to really move any type of significant police reforms, such as civilian oversight. You know, this is something that at least a dozen other municipalities in Florida have some basic level of civilian oversight participation, providing recommendations to law enforcement on proper procedures, learning about law enforcement and their tools and tactics to have a better understanding from a civilian aspect. But Jacksonville is such a major city that doesn't have it. And we think it's important for the people of Jacksonville to have a decisive voice in how they are policed, and I think that'll do a great job in terms of long-term bridging the gap between law enforcement and the community if we both understand where each other is coming from.
Now, as you mentioned, the Safer Together Committee on the City Council looked at the idea of a public safety oversight committee. That committee was dissolved by former council president Sam Newby, but they did issue a report showing strong community support for a citizen review board. Of course, that is vehemently opposed from members of the police union. You want to get this on a local ballot, is that right?
Yes, ma'am. Our plan is to, we're in the process of working through the whole process of collecting signatures, getting the language done, but our plan is to have it on the ballot by elections in 2024, because we just feel as though the voters of Jacksonville should have a voice in determining how our city is policed. And like I've said, we've, you know, a lot of community activists have gone to city council the past 5, 6, 7 years using public comment, talking to city council persons about some type of review, reform, something. And similar to other issues that I'm sure other community activists and organizers have pushed city council to try to pass some legislation to be done, we've seen inaction on those issues. And of course, on police reform, we've seen inaction. So, you know, why do we as the citizens have to wait for our 19 representatives to, you know, move? You know, I think the people of Jacksonville should have a decisive voice in determining how our communities are policed, what the civilian review look like. And we just believe that the people should have a voice. And currently in Jacksonville, there's no voice when it comes to policing for the citizens to even provide adequate recommendations besides speaking that public comment, besides sending a letter to the sheriff. There needs to be some type of institutional weight that gives us, that elevates the voice of the citizen, and especially the families most affected by police violence. And we think the Public Safety Oversight Committee will go a long way towards creating that open up barrier of communication, because as we know, and as a lot of journalists know, there's been a lack of transparency historically with the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office. And the new Sheriff Waters has come in pledging that he will be more transparent, he will be more open. But, you know, we can't forget, we saw the same thing with Sheriff Williams when he was first elected. He pledged transparency, he created a website to show police-involved shootings and whatnot, but then after 3 to 4 years, he closed up shop again and kind of turned his back to the citizens. And our fear is that if you don't have anything institutional, any type of institutional reforms in place to make the sheriff's office accountable to the people of Jacksonville, then we'll have the same situation as we had the past 8 years.
Eric in Arlington. Hi, Eric. Good morning.
Hey, real quick, there seems to be so many police in Jacksonville. I mean, it's almost like an army. It's almost like we're being occupied. And I ask myself, what are these police, what are they protecting us from? And the only conclusion I can come to is that they exist, the police are there to protect the rich from the poor, but also to destroy the poor. I mean, what else, you know, is there so much crime and whatnot in Jacksonville that we need? I don't know how many police are. There's got to be 20,000, 30,000 of these people. They're all heavily armed. I mean, what are they protecting us from? Does anyone have a theory about this? Thank you.
Well, we do have a violent crime problem in Jacksonville. And, you know, to give voice to the police argument, Michael, their argument is that they are simply doing the bidding of the voters to try to address property crimes, gun violence crimes. They claim that a civilian oversight board would be ruled by emotion and would not be impartial. What's your response to the police argument?
Well, there's other municipalities, Orange County, Orlando, Indian River County, Miami has a civilian review panel. There are other review panels across the state that works with law enforcement. Have we seen law enforcement in those areas complain about it being ruled by emotion? You know, that's a talking point that they've created to try to justify us not having a basic semblance of civilian review. I think these other areas across the state of Florida, Tampa, for example, has a civilian review board. We are the only major city in the state of Florida without some basic civilian review. And that may not be surprising. You know, this is Jacksonville, and we still have a lot of elements stuck in the 50s. But, you know, I think other places have, you know, ushered themselves into the modern age, and I think Jacksonville should too. And, you know, we do have a crime problem. I think that's always tied to poverty, the lack of funding going to these social services. I mean, even in the NPR headliner, we talked about these nonprofits dealing with the issue of crime. They were being allocated $350,000. The sheriff's office budget went up $38 million last year. Mm-hmm. And we're not calling for that to be slashed or whatnot. All we called for last year was for that $38 million increase to be reallocated towards housing and dealing with the root issue of crime. So while these other institutions that are on the ground trying to deal with the issue of crime on the base level without guns and force. They're trying to build relationships. They have to struggle for pennies from the city council. Meanwhile, the sheriff's office, which has demonstrated a lack of, and I'm not saying a lack of willingness, but the results are the results. There's been a uptick in violent crime, yet the budget has gone up. So when are we going to see, as taxpayers and people of Jacksonville, the results of that investment?
Of that investment.
As opposed to,
and I want to thank you, Michael Sampson, Jacksonville Community Action Alliance. We'll continue to follow it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Another big story this Monday, it's the ad war in Jacksonville's upcoming March mayor's race. And it's reviving kind of an old issue, the failed attempt to sell off JEA. Two Republican candidates for mayor say their opponent can't be trusted on the issue, and they're taking to the airwaves to try to make the case. David Bauerlein is covering this story for the Florida Times-Union and joins us now. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Melissa.
And as we talk about the city's mayor's race, you can join us at 549-2937. So let's talk about these accusations involving Jack's Chamber CEO Daniel Davis, candidate for mayor, and Jacksonville City Council member Leanna Cumber, also running as a Republican for mayor. What did you learn last week about their claims regarding the failed attempt to sell JEA?
So from the Cumber side, the ads attacking Davis have been that he has supported in the past when he was on city council in 2007, taking a look at what the market value of JEA would be, and then arguing that his campaign donors include people who supported the effort to explore privatization and seek bids for JEA in 2019. And they've also coupled that with a snippet of a quote from an appearance he made last year at the Tumaquana Country Club, where he talked about wanting more privatization in Jacksonville. It's a partial part of a larger quote.
Mm-hmm.
So they put that together and said, Daniel Davis, if elected mayor, will be interested in resuming the effort to sell JEA.
Which he denies.
Which he denies and says, as the mayor, he would not support selling JEA. From the Davis side, then, they kind of responded saying that Leanna Cumber's husband, while she was serving on city council, was a consulting with a company that later went on to put in a bid for JEA, and that when a city council investigative committee was looking at just the whole nuts and bolts, everything, turning over every rock in the JEA, they asked council members to disclose any relationships or interactions they or their immediate family, including spouses, had with anybody involved in any way with the JEA sales attempt,
mm-hmm.
and that she did not disclose that to the City Council Investigative Committee. So they're saying she didn't cooperate with that investigation and that she cannot be trusted to...
And what's her response to these revelations?
So her response has been that that her husband was not paid or employed by this firm and that she did not have an obligation to disclose anything about him to the Special Investigative Committee, and that she had some concerns at the time about the fact that the FBI was investigating the sale and that information in the public might cause some problems with that investigation going forward. Her husband, who had served on the JEA board, was providing information, she says, to the FBI, and he actually did later testify to a grand jury as a witness as it was investigating the sale as part of a U.S. Department of Justice probe into it.
The current mayor, Lenny Curry, who's termed out and is leaving office in the spring, seems to be casting shade over all of this with some tweets he's been putting on Twitter about candidates for mayor. What's that all about?
So if you read between the lines, I think it would be a criticism of the Leanna Cumber campaign that they launched this attack ad against Daniel Davis saying he can't be trusted, and then had in her own background the fact that her husband had been at least advising, meeting with a firm. So the argument would be that in politics, you do oppo research on yourself. You don't lob an attack where you have a vulnerability on the same issue. So So I think that's really what that tweet is about, although okay. he doesn't say it in so many words.
But it sort of begs the next question, which is, how much will the voters really care about all of this when they go into the voting booth in March? How much will this matter to them? How closely tied these two Republican candidates were to this failed attempt to privatize our utility?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question. You know, 4 years ago, Mayor Curry won re-election and basically told voters, on my watch, I will not bring forward legislation to privatize JEA. He got elected, sworn in, and 3 weeks later, the JEA board voted to seek offers for JEA. And so suddenly it was a big issue again. But during the campaign, it wasn't, because there wasn't anything happening. So, you know, perhaps voters are like, you know, there's nothing happening right now with JEA. Yeah. The main thing would be, do voters, having gone through what they went through before, to what degree do they want assurances from candidates or not that that's going to come up again, that it's going to be, you know, they're going to go through that whole drama again of JEA after the next mayor comes in, and or not. I mean, I think it's an issue to the extent that perhaps voters want to have some ability to trust the candidates on what they're saying one way or the other on that issue. Clearly, JEA is not up for sale now. You have a JEA board that's opposed to privatization of the utility. They're running it as a publicly owned utility at this point.
Yeah, at this point. And it's 549-2937. As we talk with David Bauerlein of the Florida Times-Union about the city's upcoming March mayor's race and the ad wars already happening on local television, let us know, what would you like to see in the next mayor? What do you think they should be focusing on? 549-2937, Andrew in Jacksonville. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, yes. I've been in Jacksonville about 6 years now, and I'm just curious why we're not part of FPNL when we're surrounded by everywhere else. And I'll take my answer offline. Thank you.
Sure. And you know, Andrew, really the reason why is the voters stood up against that, because this attempt to sell JEA off to the parent company of Florida Power and Light, which was set in motion by some powerful interests, not just here in Jacksonville, but around Florida. The effort failed, David, because the voters stood up with one voice and said, hell no. And we don't want that in Jacksonville.
Yeah, the whole JEA is ours. It's a very strong rallying cry. And it should be said that it was a bipartisan rallying cry. The polls showed Republicans, Democrats, moderates, all were opposed to it. So NextEra Energy, the parent company of Florida Power and Light, bid $11 billion to buy JEA. Mm-hmm. And they do surround JEA on all sides. But there's a strong feeling among people who are served by JEA that they like having a publicly owned utility that's owned by the ratepayers and not investor-owned utility that goes before a commission in Tallahassee to get its rate set.
It, you know, I have to say, and that we've had some time and space from the whole affair, even though the federal case against some former executives is still ongoing, it was a rare defeat for the power structure in Florida, of which the utilities, the investor-owned utilities like FPNL, are a big part. It was a rare example of people power winning over moneyed interests, what we saw happen in the city of Jacksonville over JEA.
Right. And it was consistent throughout. Certainly the employees of JEA were very effective in amplifying their argument. But you had a lot of city council members who were just hearing from constituents, this is not popular. The people don't want it. There was a kind of, if it ain't broke, don't fix it attitude about it. And there was a lot of distrust about who was going to benefit. And there was a lot of questions, too, about, you know, if there's this big sale, who's going to end up paying the tab for that? And is that going to then affect rates down the road? People just were saying, you know, give me all the information. They didn't feel like they were getting all of it. And there was opposition throughout from the grassroots.
Susan in Mandarin. Go ahead, Susan.
Yes, you asked what we wanted to ask the candidates. And one of the things I'm interested in is the whole debacle of the trash pickup and what their plans are to prevent that from happening again. And do they have any concrete plans to help better recycle? Like a lot of stuff is put in the recycling bins that ends up in the dump, which we don't like. And then the third related question is, do they have a position on putting water fountains that we can put our refillable water bottles underneath throughout the city, so to help reduce the use of single-use plastic? Thank you.
Sure. You know, whether it's the recycling mess, the crumbling infrastructure we have in the city, public safety issues, she mentioned environmental concerns, people want a city that works. And I think that in large swaths of this huge spread out city, people don't feel like the city is working. And, you know, they want a city that works. They want services that deliver. They want safe streets. They want better schools. They want the basics. And there's this, when I go around town and talk to people, there's this widespread frustration that we don't have that.
Well, that certainly was the case with the whole recycling thing, where for 6 months, recycling was suspended while the city tried to address some problems they had just with manpower, with not having enough people. I will say that the city is increasing the rates that these haulers get, and so they should be able to pay their drivers more. So that should make these positions be filled. That's a cost that's going to be borne by the next mayor.
Mm-hmm.
It's always an issue, I think, in terms of just the day-to-day operations of City Hall. A lot of people aren't ideologically driven. You know, they want the potholes fixed.
Mm-hmm.
They want the schools to function, which isn't really a mayoral responsibility. And they want to see, public safety.
That's right. A perennial concern. Getting back to our earlier topic, but here's an email from MG. What we need in Jacksonville is a vision from the new mayor. We need ideas and talent from Jacksonville and well beyond. And we need a vision for downtown. The Jaguars are not the only entity that matters, and development near the stadium is not downtown. Okay, thank you for that, MG. So people do want to hear from these candidates, whether it's for downtown development or beyond. What is your vision? Where do you want to take this city? And we're not hearing that yet from these attack ads.
No, not at all. Now, they'll have a little bit of a chance. I think there's going to be a televised debate that JU will have in March. There's going to be some debates that are being held by community groups. But yeah, that's a fundamental question of any campaign, which is, if you're elected, how do you want Jacksonville to be different on your last day of your four-year term compared to your first day of your four-year term? What is your vision? And it's possible sometimes these visions are so made out of tissue paper that, you know, what is it really that they want to do? But that's fundamentally what the job of the mayor is, to move the city forward.
I've actually just been asked to moderate a town hall for the mayoral candidates on February 7th on behalf of the Interfaith Center for Northeast Florida. I believe only two of them have accepted, though, so far. And there are a bunch of candidates running for mayor, so people, I think, are just starting to tune into this and trying to get a sense of who the candidates are and what they stand for.
I think that's true, and there's probably a sense of people who follow these campaigns closely that the March debate, March election won't settle it. You'll have two people who are going to be in a runoff, and then it'll be one versus one for a May runoff contest to decide who the winner is. So it's going to be a long slog. There's going to be a lot of, to the extent there will be more opportunities, a lot of opportunities for people to get some, hopefully, face-to-face time with these candidates getting out there and pressing flesh.
You've covered a lot of local campaigns and mayoral administrations. This is the most expensive mayor's race in Jacksonville history by a lot. What are your thoughts about these eye-popping amounts these candidates are raising to run for this local office?
It's astonishing, isn't it? It's like over $10 million has already been raised. And, you figure if you go to a runoff, all those people who gave once will give twice. And so maybe it's $15 million
by
the end
of it. Maybe a little grudgingly, but yeah.
And I mean, this is the kind of numbers you might see in a statewide race for some kind of office. There's just huge checks that are being cut, six-figure checks. These political committees have a huge amount of money that they can bring to it. These political committees are different from the official campaigns. There's unlimited contribution amounts. So that's where you have people who are writing, for people like, oh my God, you're writing a check that's more than my annual pay to one candidate, one political committee. But Those ads then are funded largely by those political committees that raise a lot of money, big donors who are picking sides in this race. That's why I think, you know, yeah, read the ads, but don't base your votes on them. That's
yeah,
for sure.
Now, one last thought. Governor Ron DeSantis has endorsed some local candidates for office, and certainly I think there's curiosity. Will he do the same in the Jacks mayoral election? Will he pick a candidate to support, and could that make the difference?
If he were to pick a candidate between now and the March 1st election, it definitely would make a difference. I mean, he showed when he was endorsing some candidates in the state house races that he has a huge, huge impact on those races and elevating people to the top of the pack. I'd be shocked, surprised, if he were to come out and endorse a Republican candidate when there's multiple candidates running for mayor.
But in May, he may well do it.
I mean, he's been an unconventional candidate in a lot of governor in a lot of ways, and getting involved in some of these down ballot local races where he has a strong preference one way or the other, it would make a huge difference in changing the dynamics of that race, definitely.
Here's a tweet from DP, JEA remaining public and the candidate's position in taking down Confederate monuments must be on the ballot for city council candidates and for mayor. Ask every candidate who visits your studio or calls in to your show. I'll tell you, DP, we have been asking those questions and we have invited the candidates to appear, and we'll continue to host the ones we're able to get in here. And keep asking those questions from the public. And in the meantime, thank you, David Bauerlein. Always amazing insights from him on local politics. David Bauerlein, the Florida Times Union, thank you.
Thank you, Lisa. Appreciate it.
And much more still ahead later. Cathedral Arts Project marks a milestone, but up next.
The term psychedelic itself means mind manifesting. They are able to assist someone in processing deep, emotionally laden memories in a way that leads to a better therapeutic outcome.
The growth of psychedelic drugs to treat a range of ailments, opportunities, and calls for caution. That's next.
Effective, the advertising division of Comcast. Effective uses insights from aggregated first-party data to target audiences across streaming and TV in Jacksonville. Learn more at effective.com/radio. That's EFFECTV.com/radio.
Well, there are now more than 30 million psychedelic users in this country, and some states are legalizing, decriminalizing, or funding research into the therapeutic uses of psilocybin and other psychedelic drugs. Psilocybin and MDMA are poised to be the hottest new therapeutics since Prozac. Universities want in, and so does Wall Street. But there are cautions, too. For more on this and the psychedelic revolution, I spoke with an expert, Dr. Jennifer Mitchell, is a professor in the departments of neurology and psychiatry and behavioral science in the School of Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Mitchell, it's good to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
This is such a fascinating field, and it seems as though it's exploding in terms of research and curiosity and funding. But let's begin, I guess, by just explaining, if you could, exactly what psychedelic drugs are and how they work on the brain.
Sure. So the term psychedelic itself means mind manifesting. So it's a little bit different than a hallucinogenic, which makes you see or hear something that isn't actually there. And the idea behind these compounds is that perhaps through activation of what we call a serotonin receptor in the brain, they are able to assist someone in processing deep, emotionally laden memories in a way that leads to a better therapeutic outcome.
And they really are showing promise for people with depression and other conditions. What is the research showing in terms of the potential of giving people real relief?
Well, I think that the two psychedelics that are furthest along in terms of clinical studies are MDMA for PTSD and psilocybin for treatment-resistant depression or major depressive disorders. And those clinical trials have shown that both of those compounds show tremendous promise in those particular populations.
Yeah. Ketamine in particular, I know here in Florida, people have explored that as a modality for depression. And so whether we're talking about PTSD, depression, or even chronic pain, what are your thoughts about the way some states are starting to legalize or decriminalize this substance, these meds, making it more accessible to more people?
I mean, I think that decriminalization is really interesting, and a lot of us have our eye on it to see exactly what it means for things like safety and evaluation of outcomes. Right now, I think our advice is to wait for the clinical trial data to sort of lead the way, because we don't want to make anyone worse. And we're obviously very cautiously optimistic about the promise of these compounds, but only when administered in very safe environments.
Yes, that's my next question. The downsides, the potential negative outcomes for some patients. That is a real worry, isn't it?
Well, I think so. I mean, one of the things that we learned from the 60s and 70s is that psychedelics are truly experiential medications. So their outcomes, their effects are very much dependent on the environment in which they're administered. And so for clinical trials, you're in a very safe space and you're well monitored by a medical group and group of psychedelic facilitators, and that helps ensure that your outcome is going to be a good one. But that's not necessarily going to be the case if you try this on your own at home, you know, in your living room.
Right. I mean, this is not the magic mushrooms of the Woodstock era that we're talking about, correct?
No, we're not. We're not talking about that.
Yeah, I mean, because I think that's the image many people still have in their minds. And certainly since perhaps, I guess, the Nixon administration, these psychedelic compounds have been very difficult to use in a therapeutic way. Can you explain what the current regulatory landscape is around psychedelics?
Yeah, absolutely. So unfortunately, psychedelics are all still considered Schedule I compounds by the DEA. And that means that in order to use them for research purposes, you must first approach the DEA and garner a Schedule I license, and then you must approach the FDA and file an investigational new drug application. And so that means a lot of time and money and paperwork. So the regulatory and compliance pieces are actually pretty arduous. And then in addition to that, it means that there's little to no federal funding to explore the therapeutic value of these compounds, which means that if you are going to try to conduct a clinical trial, for example, you need to go after another source of funding. So for us, that's been a lot of philanthropy, a lot of crowdsourcing over mm-hmm. the past few years to make this happen.
So if the average person wants to explore psychedelics to cure what ails them, what do you advise that they do?
I advise them to try to be as patient as possible yeah. and wait for the clinical trial data and for the FDA to evaluate the effects of those trials and to render a verdict.
Because people do seem to be exploring it on their own, finding ways to get...
Oh, absolutely. And I understand that people are quite desperate, right? I mean, mental health is a true crisis in our country, and PTSD and major depressive disorder are both very much in need of new therapeutics. But at the same time, safety first, we really just don't want to see anyone hurt or, you know, worsened by the use of any drug.
Well, thanks for sharing your insights with us. She's Dr. Jennifer Mitchell, professor in the Department of Neurology and Psychiatry and Behavioral Science in the School of Medicine at UC San Francisco. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Have a good afternoon.
We was driving to downtown LA about a midnight hour, and it almost blew my mind. I got caught in a colored shower. Those lights were twinkling on sunset. I saw a sign in the sky.
Well, the city's Cathedral Arts Project is celebrating its 30th anniversary this month. Mayor Lenny Curry has proclaimed today Cathedral Arts Project Day in the city of Jacksonville. CAP has provided thousands of students, primarily those living in under-resourced communities around town, with professional arts education in art as therapy, dance, media arts, music, theater, and visual arts. Here now with more, the Reverend Kimberly Hyatt, CEO of the Cathedral Arts Project. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Ariel Allen, a sixth grade student enrolled in a CAP dance class. Hey, Ariel.
Hi.
Good to see you. So, Kimberly Hyatt, let's start with you. Congrats. Today is CAP Day in the city of Jacksonville. That's exciting.
Yes, we're all very excited.
Mm-hmm. And you're celebrating 30 years, so tell us about that.
Yes. Yeah, so, you know, Melissa, you were just saying you've been here 14 years. 30 years ago, Jacksonville was a very different place. If a child grew up wanting to play violin or to learn to dance, and they happened to have been born into a family with limited time, money, or resources, they never really got a chance to explore that dream because there were no organizations like CAP around. But that all began to change when our founder and her son started talking about their dreams around their breakfast table. And out of that, an idea grew for CAP. And so they began with a small group of people, one dance class, and 10 students from a transitional housing facility. And they put into motion what is now a nationally recognized organization, one providing 31,000 children with access to free arts education, and one that is making great strides in helping the district to provide more arts education and inspiring other organizations to get off the ground as well.
Now, in 2013, CAP engaged the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts to be considered for their Any Given Child program. Jacksonville became the 14th Any Given Child community. Only about a couple of dozen such communities in the nation. So that's just one of a long list of honors for the Cathedral Arts Project. We should disclose that our own senior producer, Heather Schatz, is a board member of CAP. And the whole idea is that arts education helps kids academically and socially, and that it should be available to all kids, right?
It is. We're so proud of our work with the Any Given Child Initiative. That's a cross-sector collective impact initiative because we can't do this work alone. But we've had great successes. Since then, we've had a 30% increase in the number of arts educators that the district employs, $17 million in scholarships to high school seniors. And also, most recently, we conducted some research to see what the gaps were. And 84% of school principals asked for more resources for arts and music supplies. And so we were thrilled that Superintendent Green included a portion of the revenue from the recent millage increase for more arts and music supplies. And we're already hearing from teachers who are just so thrilled to have that.
That's great. Now, Ariel, you're in sixth grade and you are enrolled in the Cathedral Arts Project in dance. Is that right?
Yes.
What do you like about it?
I like about it because it's like something to get away from school. You look forward to at the end of the day.
So you go to CAP after school?
Yes.
Yeah? And so tell me about it. What all goes on in dance class?
Like, you have to find the music, and you have to, like, to find, a, like, the dance that goes, like, best with the music.
Uh-huh.
And, like, sometimes you get to perform the dance, and it's, like, in front of people.
Do you like performing?
Yeah.
What do you like about it?
Like, you get to show people what you've been working on. And how, like, fun it is and stuff.
Do you have a recital, a dance recital coming up this spring? Probably.
Yeah.
I would think. So how long have you been involved with CAP? What was it like when you were able to start doing the dance classes?
Well, I started, like, last school year in fifth grade.
Yeah?
And we had, was, like, just starting at the school. So it was, like, not knowing it, people stuff. So, like, it started out from a small group, and then it grew bigger.
Does it make you feel differently about school now that you know you have dance to look forward to?
Yeah.
How does it make you feel differently about school?
Because, like, at school, like, it's, like, a lot going on. You have to keep focused. But when you go to dance, it's, like, you can let loose and have, like, playful mood.
Sure. And kids need that, you know. So, I guess, Kimberly, that gives you an idea of how this program is helping kids succeed in school.
Oh, absolutely. The numbers really tell the story. We see time and time again, kids score better on standardized tests. They do better in reading, math, and science. Their attendance goes up. Behavioral issues go down. The arts also help kids to find their voice and to use it for good. We hear time and time again of children who are quiet and never speak up in class until they get in a CAP class. And then they find their voice, and then they start speaking up in all of their classes. And so we know that that's really a key to success in school and in life. There are just, you know, there's something about the arts that can reach kids in ways nothing else can, and in ways that will stay with them for life.
I'm so glad Cathedral Arts Project is here to fill these gaps in arts education throughout the community. And at the same time, it's unfortunate that it needs to exist. You know, when I was a kid in middle school at a public school in a little town, there was a full orchestra, a full band, a full theater program. All of those programs, for the most part, have been systematically stripped out of public education budgets, leading to this situation.
They have. There definitely is not enough arts education. At the same time, one of the things CAP does is to work for the district to provide more. And we have seen progress over the past decade in that regard.
What are some examples you've seen of progress?
We see particularly at the elementary level that we do have art and music for every elementary child. We've also seen a 30% increase in the number of art and music instructors that the district has hired on a full-time basis.
Because you've made the data-driven case for it, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, the data is clear.
Exactly.
Okay, so Mayor Curry has proclaimed today, January 30th, as Cathedral Arts Project Day in the city of Jacksonville. How can listeners celebrate the work that you're doing and celebrate the day?
So we have an art exhibition on display in Tolliver Hall at St. John's Episcopal Cathedral. Anyone is welcome to stop by there. People are also invited to come to our downtown offices for a tour. And the easiest thing is probably to go to our website, capkids.org, sign up for our newsletter, or learn all about our upcoming events, including Ariel's dance recital coming up at the end of March.
Oh, so yeah, so there is a big recital, Ariel. What's your costume going to be like? Do you know yet?
No, I don't know.
But it's ballet and modern dance?
Yeah.
That's exciting. I bet you're really good. I bet you're one of the best, or they wouldn't have asked you to come talk on the radio, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So what do you want to be when you grow up?
Well, I did want to become a police officer, but I'm not sure anymore.
Well, you have plenty of time to decide. And in the meantime, I want to thank you for coming out today and being with us. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Ariel Allen is a sixth grader enrolled in Cathedral Arts Project programs. The Reverend Kimberly Hyatt, for 20 years now, has been the CEO of the Cathedral Arts Project. Today is Cathedral Arts Project Day by mayoral proclamation in the city of Jax. Thank you both.
Thank you.
When we come back, the Super Bowl field is set. That's next.
In 2004, a deadly virus started spreading in Bangladesh.
It was not understood what was happening. Some people who were transporting the patients to the hospital were also getting sick.
Eventually, researchers confirmed it was a bat-borne virus called Nipah. We'll go into the forest with them as they try to understand and contain it. I'm Ari Shapiro. That story on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Starting at 4 on WJCT News 89.9. I'm Vipa Fernandez. 29-year-old Tyree Nichols is now the latest in a long line of black men killed by police.
Tyree now will become the new face of the racial justice movement. And essentially what that makes him is a martyr.
How his death has rocked the city of Memphis and what's next for the city's police department, next time on Here and Now.
Today at 1 on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, when a doctor becomes the patient, neurosurgeon Henry Marsh describes how his own cancer diagnosis led him to reflect on the doctor-patient relationship, his own mortality, and medically assisted death. He'll talk about his memoir called And Finally, and about his trips to Ukraine, performing surgery and working to improve the country's medical system. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
It started 100 years ago with a mouse. Since the days of Steamboat Willie, Disney has been dominant. This year, Hollywood's biggest studio plans to invest more in original content than any other company. Its theme parks alone brought in more than $28 billion in 2022. Next time on 1A, what can we expect from another century of Disney?
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, the Super Bowl matchup is set as the Philadelphia Eagles will take on the Kansas City Chiefs. Even though the Jaguars didn't make it all the way, that hasn't stopped them from adding some hardware to their trophy case. Here with some thoughts about the weekend sports, our own Josh Torres. Hey, did you watch the game last night?
I watched both games, and definitely some very good football. And we did get what I think a lot of people wanted. We have what are considered the two best teams in football playing in the Super Bowl, being the Philadelphia Eagles, who were the number one seed in the NFC, and the Kansas City Chiefs, who were the number one seed in the AFC. So we have number one going against number one. So that kind of is the matchup that we really did want to see. I personally really did think that the Bengals should have won their game last night.
I kind of agree.
I felt like there were some calls that really did not go their way, especially late in the game. But obviously that is my opinion. My opinion only means so much. But when it comes down to it, they still weren't able to get some of those plays that they need to done, which happens in football. And so the Kansas City Chiefs are moving on. And this game should be very, very exciting.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Who do you like to win it all?
I really like Philly, honestly. I really do like Philadelphia. I feel like the aura around that team is just, it's so high. They absolutely dominated San Francisco, who has one of the top defenses in the league, and just absolutely eviscerated them. But obviously, don't count out Kansas City. Kansas City has shown to be a team that can really come at you when you think that you have them on the ropes. They come back at you. I think back to last year when they played Buffalo in the playoffs, and that final minute of play in the fourth quarter was some of the best football I've ever seen, where both teams are just going back and forth. But the big question is going to surround Patrick Mahomes. What's his ankle looking like? You know, he played on it last night, and towards the end of the game, you could tell he very much could not put pressure on his right leg. He was hobbling after throws, very much showed that that ankle is way worse than they're probably letting on, which teams are going to notice that. And so, but he will have a few weeks to heal up before he has to play in the game. So that's going to be the big question. But I really, really do like Philadelphia. My brother-in-law, Ryan, who is a huge Philadelphia fan, is probably going to love hearing that. But I really do like Philadelphia in this game.
Okay, so bringing it back to Duval, our season ended, but with a lot of excitement and pride. The Jaguars did bring home some of their own hardware. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so Coach Doug Peterson, who obviously formerly coached the Philadelphia Eagles to their own Super Bowl victory, he was named the AFC Coach of the Year by the 101 Awards. Obviously, he's the second coach in Jags history to win that honor, the other being Doug Marrone, who won it back in 2017 when the Jags went to the AFC Championship game. But it really shows you, again, something I've been harping on all year, which it just shows you how much Doug Peterson really has meant to the team and building a culture. I mean, the last 2 years in a row, they've had the number one overall pick. Earlier this year, we were talking about, are they going to have it 3 years in a row? And he turned them around and got them to the playoffs, and it really shows you. And not only did he win that award, he's been named as a finalist for the AP NFL Coach of the Year. He will be going. The other two finalists are Kyle Shanahan of the San Francisco 49ers and Brian Daboll of the New York Giants. And it's, and all of them have some very good resumes on why it should, they should win. In my opinion, I think it's really going to, it should come down to Doug Peterson and Brian Daboll. Whether who's going to win, I don't know. I really do think Doug Peterson deserves it because of the, what I just talked about. Team had the number one overall pick 2 years in a row. He's completely switched that culture around and brought him to the playoffs and to where fans are excited and really do believe this is just the starting point. And not only the fans believe it, the players believe it. And that is one of the biggest things for a really, really good NFL coach to show that why he should be the coach of the year, in my opinion.
One key hire can mean such a difference. Okay, lastly, it's Josh Torres' favorite time of year as the motor racing season gets underway in Daytona with the Rolex 24. What was that race like and who went home with a brand new watch?
Yeah, I really love this time of year. It's right when the motor sports season gets started. We started out with the Rolex 24. I was actually there all weekend. It was awesome to see. It's my first time ever going out there, and I got to be there as a fan, so it was very nice kind of getting to roam around, see everything going on. And you get 24 hours of racing from 1:40 p.m. on Saturday to 1:40 p.m. on Sunday. They are running basically nonstop, except for their pit stops, and if they do have a problem on the car, they have to bring it into the garage. But other than that, it's just nonstop racing. And it came down to, yet again, the Acura from Meyer-Shank Racing, which was driven by Tom Blomqvist, Colin Braun, Helio Castroneves, Simon Pagenaud. They won. It's their second year in a row winning. It's actually Helio Castroneves' third year in a row winning this race, so he now has three brand new Rolex watches that he's gotten. They even asked him after the race, where are you going to put all these watches? Are you going to wear all of them at the same time? But it's awesome. It was an awesome race. And then at the end, in the secondary class LMP2, it came down to a last lap drag race to the finish, and John Allen won by the length of his diffuser on the front of his car. He won by 0.16 seconds. It was an absolutely amazing race.
Photo finish.
Congratulations to all the winners, and it was a great race, and now we have more motorsports to add to the year.
Thank you, Josh.
Thank you, Melissa.
And thanks, everyone, and thanks as well to David Luckin, Heather Schatz, Brendan Rivers, Isabella Da Silva, and Michelle Corum. You can drop us all a line anytime at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you tomorrow morning at 9 a.m.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.